We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, a lot of the news that we get bombarded with every day has to do with economics. And I don't know about you, but me, I find it all pretty confusing, particularly when we talk about what governments do. But if you reduce it to its most basic level, really what economics is all about is how societies and also how people allocate scarce resources. Our guest for this hour, writer Paula Schumann, she's a writer for the Wall Street Journal. She says that that is exactly the same puzzle, this allocating of resources, the same puzzle that couples are trying to solve. How do we spend limited time, limited energy, limited money in ways that keep everybody happy? In this hour of Focus, we will try to look at what the dismal science of economics has to tell us about keeping peace in the family, and we will talk about some of what you will find in a recent book. The title is Spousonomics, the subtitle Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. It is published by Random House. There are two authors, Paula Schumann. She's the page one editor at the Wall Street Journal, where she was previously reporter covering travel and lifestyle trends. Her co-author on the book is Jenny Anderson. She is a reporter for the New York Times. Paula Schumann is joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We got a toll-free line, so you can use that if it would be a long-distance call. That's 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And Ms. Schumann, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Well, I think that I would want to point out that while this book will, I think, help one get a better understanding of some basic economic principles, that it's not an economics book. It's a relationship book.
Right.
And that leads to the question of all of the ways in which you could approach how relationships work and could be improved, how did you decide that using economics would be a good way in?
Well, I mean, economics is romantic, right? It's totally obvious to us. well, we actually both thought that it was a more practical approach to solving relationship problems. You know, I work at the Wall Street Journal, and Jenny has been a longtime Wall Street reporter. So these are kinds of things that, I mean, neither of us are economists, but we've been dealing with the business journalism world for a long time. And we started writing the book right around the time when the U.S. economy was about to implode. So there was just sort of economics all around us. And it seemed like there were a lot of parallels that kind of surprised us and that we thought would be useful ways to think about relationships in ways that people hadn't before. Jenny and I are very practical, I'm not going to say we're practical, but we're very goal-oriented. You know, we were both newly married, and we wanted wanted to think about our marriage in a more solution-based way, not really like a squishy, wishy-washy way. So we just thought economics would be different and fun, and it turned out to be surprisingly useful and relevant.
Hmm. Well, so you did two things. You started out actually talking with economists about this subject. That is, tell me, Mr. and Ms. Economist,
right.
what it is that you have learned by being an economist that you can apply to relationships.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first person I called, I had this idea, actually. It was my husband who inadvertently gave me the idea one day when we were having a rough patch in our marriage, and he drew a graph of our marital mood over time, looking at the highs and lows over the previous 2 weeks, and it just seemed like we laughed about it. And laughter is always a good thing when you're having a tense moment with your spouse. And I got to thinking, like, maybe there's an empirical way to look at our relationship. Anyway, the first person I called was actually Gary Becker, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics and who was one of the first economists to talk about the economics of the household. And I was a little bit intimidated because he's pretty famous. And, you know, he picked up the phone and I said, "Do you think this is a worthy book?" And he said, "Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I use it all the time in my house." And I sort of took it from there, and we called dozens and dozens of economists, and we're still in touch with a lot of them. And, you know, they would tell us what they thought was sort of relevant from their research towards marriage and also what they'd learned in their own marriages that were relevant. And then we also called up a lot of marriage counselors, and of course we spoke to hundreds of couples, and that's the real core of the book, is people's stories.
Yeah, you really spent a lot of time, traveled across the country and spent time sitting down with people and actually getting them to talk about what their issues are, where the sources of conflict are, and then maybe how it is they went about trying to deal with it.
Right, yeah, and that was the most exciting part about the research, is, you know, getting people to sort of open up about their marriages. And we would throw out some economic ideas in the discussion, and they would say, oh my God, that makes complete sense with what I'm dealing with in my relationship. Or they would throw out, you know, what's going on with them, what are their biggest issues, what are the things that they continually struggle with, and that would give us some ideas about, you know, what economics might fit with that.
Yeah. And what seems to be remarkable is that people they were not your close personal friends.
No.
But were actually willing to talk very openly about a lot of things, including their sex lives.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you'd be surprised how people will talk about their sex lives with complete strangers. well, we you know, a lot of people we interviewed one-on-one were people, you know, that we got connected through with people that we know. So they were a few degrees of separation away from us. And that's the other reason we also conducted separately a nationwide randomized survey that we hired a survey company to do. And that gives a lot of, we call that our exhaustive, groundbreaking, and very expensive marriage survey. And we quote that in the book. And we wanted to make sure that we had a balance, you know, sort of complete strangers across all demographics with people who might be somewhat more demographically close to us.
Real quick, our guest in this hour of Focus, Paula Schumann. She is a page one editor at the Wall Street Journal. She's the co-author with Janie Anderson of the recent book Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. And it takes a look at how some basic principles that work in economics can be applied to people as they're trying to relate and live with one another under one roof. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk at illinois.edu. Whenever two people live together, I suppose they don't even have to be married. If they're living together, mm-hmm. there is one big issue that they have to face, and that is, well, stuff has to get done.
Right.
lots of stuff has to get done, and you have to divide things up. And no one wants to feel that he or she is doing more than their fair share of the stuff. So then the question is, well, what's the best kind of strategy to approach getting stuff done?
Right. Well, first of all, you said it right there. Like, you should have a strategy. Mm. And I think a lot of people are surprised that, you know, housework and dividing, you know, as we call it, division of labor, as an economist would describe it, that tends to be so fraught. You know, that should be, you know, we love each other, we get married, like, you know, that should carry the day. Well, you know, and suddenly you find yourselves arguing about the dishes and the laundry and the gutters, et cetera, and feeling like you're, like you said, like it's not fair somehow. So we suggest borrowing a principle from economics called comparative advantage, which the idea is that each country should specialize in what they do best relative to other, they should produce what they do best relative to other things. So if you look at it in the domestic sphere, if I am much better at the dishes than I am at the laundry, and you are actually better at the laundry than you are at the dishes, then we should each specialize in those tasks rather than obsessively trying to have everything be split down the middle. Like you said at the beginning, you know, it's all about limited resources. We have limited resources, and we don't want to waste them on the unpleasant stuff. And the more we're trying to be 50-50, the more we're keeping score, and that's using up those resources, the time and the energy that, you know, we could be putting towards leisure.
See, and I think this is really interesting, and I think that it's a great thing for people to be thinking about, because my feeling is probably that now more and more couples who are going into marriage go in with this idea that they want an egalitarian kind of
right.
marriage, which I'm sure in a lot of people's minds, at least up front, means 50-50.
Right.
That means, you know, whatever gets done, half the time you do the laundry, half the time I do the laundry. Half the time you cook, half the time I cook. And they actually will, I'm sure, if you ask them going in, how do you expect things to be divided up? I'm sure a lot of people would say, oh, right down the line, it's going to be 50-50. And then once they get into it, they realize, no, that doesn't really work. And what you're saying is, well, that's okay. It doesn't have to, everything doesn't have to be 50-50, as long as both people feel that they're putting in the same and they're getting out the same.
Right. So you don't want a situation, obviously, we're not saying, oh, it shouldn't be 50-50, it should be 100-0. You know, we're just saying that if you specialize in tasks, you will find that, and you use this principle of comparative advantage, and there's some fun math in there that you can ignore because the bottom line is that you end up saving overall time that you were spending on the chores. And like you said, I mean, we assume that it'll be 50-50, and if you specialize, it might not, on a given day, it might not feel 50-50, you know. If there happen to be a lot of dishes that day and no laundry, then I'm going to feel like I'm doing more. But, you know, over the life of a marriage, which we describe as something that should be a long-term investment, it all should even out in the end. And we actually talk about another idea that economists talk about, and they use a fancy term, which is inequity aversion. And what it really means is that we really start to get tense when we feel like things aren't fair. And that can make us really obsessed with fairness and start to act irrationally when we feel like things aren't fair. We have a couple in the book we nicknamed the Bickersons who, you know, they were so obsessed with 50-50 that if one saw the other person lounging on the couch while they were working, they would stop what they were doing because it just didn't seem fair. And it was driving them insane.
Did you find, I'm sure that there are people who, in the interest of trying to get things done and in the interest of fairness, do come up with fairly complicated systems to try to meet both those two things. And there may be also a point of diminishing returns, you know, how much energy you put into setting up and making your system run.
Right.
Did you find anybody who had what you would think would actually a pretty good way of trying to deal with that?
Well, I think the people who seem to be most successful at it are the people who, once they decide who's going to do what, they do two things. One is they are flexible, meaning that they are willing to change those specialties when circumstances change. One person loses their job, or one person gets, tired of what they're doing, or, is more interested in trying something else because they might hate it less, So they're adaptable, first of all. And second of all, they don't they let the other person do their job. They don't micromanage. You know, you don't see people from the U.S. going over to Chinese factories and saying, oh, I don't really like the way that you're making this flat panel television. Can you make it this way? Can you make it faster? You know, once you have your job, you got to let them do it. And we found like a lot of the sources of tension was, well, he's not doing it right. He's not doing it fast enough. I would do it this way. Strangely, a lot of people arguing about how they load the dishwasher. I found an unusual number of men who have very picky ways about loading the dishwasher. that micromanaging can take up a lot of time. And, again, it's just a waste of resources. So I feel like the people who – and, this was a lesson definitely that I had to learn as well in my own marriage. It seems obvious, but, if they don't do it perfectly like you do, that's kind of okay. It's not like the dishes aren't going to suffer because of that.
Yeah. Well, I think that it also points to the fact that there maybe has to, at some point, you have to make some sort of deliberate effort to think about this. Think about the couples where one person in the couple somehow thinks the other person should be a mind reader,
right,
and know exactly what needs to be done,
right,
and how it should be done. You can't.
Mind reading is very bad in relationships, and we have a whole chapter called Asymmetric Information or Why You Should Tell Each Other Stuff. The idea being that information really makes economies run smoothly. We need information in order to be able to make transactions and know what we're getting. Same in a marriage. Like we met a lot of people who said, he should know that I'm upset, or he should know that X has to get done. And guess what? They're not going to know it unless you tell them. We're not savants here.
Yeah. Loss aversion. This is a great one because it underscores what is a very basic point that I'm sure everybody knows. People don't like to lose.
Right.
And as a result of the fact that we have this very basic need not to lose, that leads people to do stuff that just really doesn't make sense, except that it can be explained by this very basic sort of idea.
Right, right. The concept of loss aversion, again, a sort of like fancy way of saying we hate to lose and we act irrationally when we lose. And economists talk about it often in terms of, you know, money and traders on the stock market who, you know, when a stock is going down and it's clearly not going to be going back up, they will hold on to it in order not to desperately trying to win back what they've lost, even though as they're doing so, they're losing even more. And, you know, there's studies about how much more people lose when they're in the throes of loss aversion. And it's also why there's pawn shops next to casinos. You know, they know that when people are losing, they're going to bet the house. So, you know, economists even say that we hate to lose twice as much as we love to win. So if I lose $200, if I lose $100, I need to win back $200 in order to feel better. So what does this all have to do with marriage? Well, a lot. We talk about it in a few ways, but one of them is when you're engaged in when you're arguing, when you're fighting, and especially, you know, late at night when you're both tired, you've exhausted those resources, and at a certain point, you know, you want to be right. In our survey, 34% of people said that they keep arguing even after they know that they're wrong, because they want to win. You know, you've invested so much in this argument that you need some concession, and you will keep clinging until you get it. And that's why we say, actually, the old advice of never go to bed angry is not really always wise advice. Sometimes it's good to go to bed angry, because one of the cures for loss aversion is a timeout to get back that clarity and peace of mind and stop acting irrationally.
See, I think that's also a really important piece of advice, because we have been told that if you're having a fight, you're supposed to try to achieve some kind of closure,
right.
And that you shouldn't go to bed angry. But it, as you say, maybe sometimes what you should do, you should just stop.
Right.
Just stop. And you know, sometimes I think the key to a long marriage is knowing when to shut up.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's something that I'm learning as I go. I haven't been married that long, but I have learned that knowing when to stop talking is kind of it's just so key, you know. I mean, that's just not always the solution. And again, you know, our idea with economics is a practical way of approaching problems. And guess what? Like, arguing and going in circles all night, when it doesn't seem to solve anything. So maybe there's another way of approaching it. And it's very hard. It takes a lot of willpower when you're in the throes of this loss aversion, because your mind has gone kind of nuts. And especially if it's late at night, it takes a lot of willpower. But when you do it and you take a break, you know, 9 times out of 10, when I do that, I just don't care as much in the morning. And if I do, we can talk about it, but we're more level-headed, you know, and we resolve it.
And does that make it easier then if you were the person who was wrong to say, okay?
Right,
yes,
exactly.
I was wrong.
Exactly, and you just have more goodwill towards each other. I mean, first of all, you've slept, right? And sleeping is always a good thing. You don't need an economist to tell you that sleeping is good.
We are getting close to the midpoint of this hour of Focus. My name is David Inge, and this is our morning talk show. Our guest this morning in this hour is Paula Schumann. She's page one editor at The Wall Street Journal, where she also has covered the travel industry and lifestyle trends. She's co-author with Jenny Anderson, who works for The New York Times, of the book Spouseonomics. The subtitle is Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. Random House is the publisher. If you're just joining us, you missed a little bit of the beginning, you can catch up or hear the rest of the show, hear some other shows by going to our website, by the way. It's willill.illinois.edu. And you can call us if you have questions, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to stay with that for a second, I'm still kind of interested in what you learned about, particularly if there is an argument and you know really that you're wrong, how to encourage yourself to give, and is there some way, in the book you talk a lot about systems of reward, you know, people they will do something if they feel that they can get something out of it,
right?
So, you know, what's the reward for admitting that the other person is right?
Well, the reward is, you know, there's a lot of rewards. First of all, the argument can end, and that's a great thing. there's also this notion of, you know, your reputation, and there's a whole branch of economics called reputation theory, and what you know, how people are, what, how your reputation affects, you know, how you're treated by others. And, you know, in marriage, again, it's a long-term investment where things are going to be repeated. You know, you're going to be repeating certain interactions, and you're going to have another argument at some point. And having a reputation as someone who can admit that they're wrong, or as someone who is flexible and willing to listen to the other person, can be actually good for the next time around, because it makes the other person feel that they can trust you, and it makes the other person feel like it's safe for them to admit that they might be wrong. It develops this good sort of like karmic goodwill, which, you know, I don't know if there's been any economic papers that use the word karma, but the idea of reputation and that being, and, you know, trust being a really good incentive. If I trust that you are not going to lay into me all night, making sure that I admit that I'm wrong at some point, then, you know, that's a good incentive for me down the road to be able to give that back to you. And, you know, trust is a great incentive.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about sex.
Okay.
We should have said that right at the beginning. That way. If I had said at the beginning, sex instead of economics.
Right. I mean, it's a Tuesday morning. It's always a good thing to talk about.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, if you list the things about which people fight, sex and are we having enough of it is, I'm sure, a big thing. One person wants to, the other person doesn't. And then I think more and more what we hear from people is that it's not happening, and it's because both of us are too tired, too busy, we got too many other things on our mind, and the idea of making an appointment for it is a turnoff. I'm sure that the people you talk to, that everybody says the same kind of stuff about this and those very things.
Right. Although I will say there's definitely a correlation in the survey that we did between satisfaction in marriage and frequency of sex. So you say, you know, making an appointment is a turnoff, but however you get to the bedroom, the point is once you're there, it seems to be good for the marriage. Mm. You know, people who have more sex might be happier. People who are happier might have more sex. It's all, we don't know what the cause is, but, you know, in our survey and also in other studies, there seems to be a correlation between a happy marriage and a good sex life. So, you know, that, let's assume that that's the goal. Like you said, you know, so why aren't people doing it as much? And the number one reason people gave us that in our survey was that they were too tired, which again goes back to this resource issue. You know, by the time at the end of the day, you know, they've just used up all their resources. And when I say resources, like, again, there's a limited time in the day, there's a limited amount of energy, and just what you have to give to the other person when you've, you know, given so much at the office already and given so much to your kids, and really what you want to do is curl up with the crossword puzzle. So too tired. So how do we approach that? And of course, our solution, which is completely obvious, is, you know, supply and demand, and the idea that, you know, keep the cost down so that demand goes up. The general rule in economics, and there's exceptions, of course, is that when costs go down, demand goes up, and when costs of something rises, demand goes down. You see that right now with the cost of gasoline being a real deterrent for people to get into the car. So that was sort of where we started, and and by lowering the cost, we don't mean actually making it cheaper, like monetarily, unless you want to pay your spouse for sex, in which case that's out of my purview and sounds exciting and you should go for it. But when we say cost, we talk about, we mean more like the amount of energy it takes. You know, try and find a time during the day when it's going to be less, when it's going to feel less like less like work and more available to you.
And that's one of the things that maybe is going to make it more challenging, because people are actually going to have to think about it. And
right.
We all have this idea that it's supposed to be wild and spontaneous, and maybe at some points it is and still can be. But on the other hand, when you have all kinds of responsibility and people are working hard and you're working to try to maintain the household, and if you have children on top of all of that, that it just gets very difficult. So then that does mean that probably you are actually going to have to say, okay, when would be really the best time?
Right.
And just say, okay, we're going to pencil it in there, and we're going to say, okay, this is the time. And
you're probably not going to regret doing it. Yeah. I mean, you know, like, it might feel like work at the time, but, you know, I think most married people who love each other, are attracted to each other, they don't regret having done it once they do it. You know, we have a couple in the book that we interviewed, and, you know, they realized that they couldn't remember the last time they had sex, and it was really depressing to them because they they used to have a good sex life and then they had a kid, and you know, it just seemed to be, you know, the bottom of their priority list, and they were never doing it. So they made a goal of 3 times a week that they were going to do it no matter what, and all their friends were very skeptical. But, you know, according to them, they did it, and they just, they made sure they did it as soon as they put their kid to bed and before they had dinner, because they noticed that if they waited till they got in bed after dinner, they were just exhausted, you know, more exhausted with the tryptophan or the wine or whatever. And then, of course, it was a motivating factor because they knew they could, you know, have dinner afterwards. but they made sure they did it 3 times a week, period. You know, no exceptions, no excuses. And they said, you know, they started having a lot more sex. And, you know, was it that sort of like honeymoon period, amazing, mind-blowing sex? You know, not most of the time, no, but it didn't matter because it was very good.
All right. We have a caller here, and I have an email we'll get in. And, again, we're a little bit past our midpoint. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Someone on a cell phone here, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah, hi.
I was just going to say that the idea of wild and spontaneous sex is one theory, but anticipation of something you know is going to happen is also a great thing.
Oh,
that's all I've got to say.
No, I completely 100% agree. And I think, you know, we also interviewed this other couple who were trying to figure out a way to have more sex, and they started texting each other during the day. They would say, okay, you know, let's do it tonight. And they would say, what are you wearing? And they would say, oh, I'm wearing this. And by the time they got home, they had been anticipating it all day. And that is a great point.
All right. I thank the caller. I get an email from someone here. I don't know how you could react to this. I think it's a nice thought. Someone who writes, I don't know if there's a principle in economics that is the equivalent of this, but the thought is resentment and love cannot live in the same heart.
Resentment and love
cannot live in the same heart. I like that. It's a really nice thought, whether that there's any economic principles that underlie that or...
Well, I mean, I would go back to this idea of information exchange and transparency, and I think resentment tends to build up when there's not an open line of communication, when two people aren't being transparent with each other. Not to say that, you know, communicating solves all your problems and you stop being angry when you tell someone, but if you're being transparent with each other and you're talking things through, then there's no way you can build up resentment.
Ah, excellent. That's really a sort of a simple idea on the one hand, and yet that's really important because, yeah, you know, if you go around, if you trash bag stuff, that's the psycho babble I get for it, I guess. You know, you save up little hurts, little annoyances, stuff that bothers you, that it assumes a weight greater than the sum,
right,
of the parts. And then if you hit somebody over the head with that trash bag, then that's going to be a big problem. Whereas if you dealt with the little things bit by bit, that wouldn't happen.
Right, right.
Orland Park, another caller here, on our toll-free, line four. Hello.
Hi, this is from a couple that's married 45 years, so I guess we've been through the argument things more than once. One thing we find, it's keep to the subject. This isn't about his mother or, you know, leaving clothes on the floor or any old arguments. Don't bring up any old arguments. The one you're having is enough to talk about. And sometimes when you're finished arguing, you can't even remember what the heck the beginning of the argument was. So it just shows sometimes they're really
yeah,
a waste of effort. And we found that, well, we're both first children, so let me tell you, everybody wants to run the show at our house. We found that saying you're sorry is good, but if you're not to the point of saying you're sorry, saying I'm sorry we fought, because that is the truth, you're always sorry you fought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So that's my words of wisdom.
Well, I appreciate the words of wisdom.
You actually, you know, it's funny you say that, because we did this survey and 34% of people said they'll sometimes keep arguing when they can't even remember what they were arguing about to begin with. So I think you really hit the nail on the head. And when you talk about, you know, not bringing up the whole kitchen sink, you know, just sticking to the point, you know, not to try and too many parallels, but we actually talk about that as well. And there's this idea in economics called information processing costs, and those are the costs incurred in having to process all the information that's coming at you. So the simple the simple analogy is when you're in the supermarket aisle and you want to buy a box of cereal and you're confronted with dozens and dozens of choices and it's all overwhelming. And, you know, we feel that way. The same thing applies, you know, when you're arguing with your spouse or when you're trying to get a point across and you decide to throw in everything, you know, again, about his mother, about this baggage, about this and the other thing, that it makes the other person completely paralyzed and it doesn't actually further the cause of your, further your cause.
Right. You don't solve a thing when you bring up every trash that you can think of. And another thing is when you get married, you both have to make a commitment that this is for life. And you know what? It forces you to work out things that otherwise you'd say, well, the H-E-L-L.
Right. Marriage itself, as an economist would say, is a great incentive to you know, treat each other well. I mean, it can also be a disincentive because you know, oh well, the other person's. I'm already married. You know, like I don't have to try hard anymore at all. And we do talk about that in the book as well, which is a whole other can of worms. But you know, in the best possible world, it's an incentive to be your best self.
Right. Anyhow, all right. Great topic.
Well,
today.
Thank you very much. Let's stay with that for a moment because that's also a big thing that you deal with. And that is a problem that when people are together and maybe the longer that they are together, it's easy to take your partner for granted.
Right.
You don't feel like you have to work at things the way that you do when you're courting that person. And it's very easy to settle into routines and to get all wrapped up in what you're doing and what's going on with you and not maybe thinking very much about what's going on with the other person.
Yeah, you know, it's a real pitfall. And it's kind of surprising because, again, you would think it's an incentive, you know, marriage can be and should be an incentive to be your best self and, you know, and treat your loved one well, but it can also be an incentive to get lazy, to, again, like we talked about before, to just, you know, put off having sex, to, you know, we talked to people, you know, in our survey, a large majority of people said that they were less affectionate with their spouses than they were when they first got married, that they had gained weight since they had gotten married, most people said, that they had less, that they were having less sex, et cetera. And, you know, we peg this to the idea of moral hazard, which in economics means that we tend to take greater risks when there are no repercussions for our actions. And you saw a lot of that in the headlines when the U.S. financial crisis happened because, you know, all the big banks that were considered too big to fail that had to be rescued by the government, Citi and AIG, et cetera, there was this notion, well, I guess they could afford to take these big risks with subprime mortgages and people's money because they knew at the end of the day the government would bail them out. And feeling like you're going to get bailed out no matter what, feeling like marriage is just a safety net, can be very dangerous because you end up, you know, taking your partner for granted and not putting in your all, like we talked about earlier. You're perfectly willing to put in your all if you know that you're going to get it back from the other person.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus is Paula Schumann. She is page one editor to the Wall Street Journal. She's the co-author with Jenny Anderson of the book Spousonomics, and the subtitle says it all, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. It is a book about relationships. You can actually learn a little bit about economics, but the idea is to take some basic economic principles and look at how that applies to relationships and how people try to get their needs satisfied. And it's published by Random House, and it is out now if you want to read the book. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you want to send an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Do you, in fact, think that there are a lot of people who think of their marriages as too big to fail?
I think that, you know, even if they haven't articulated that way, they do. Oddly enough, we did one discussion group with a group of guys up in Boston, and, you know, we threw out this question, you know, anybody know what moral hazard is and think about it? And the one guy among us, he said, oh my God, my marriage is totally too big to fail. And actually, he meant it in this other way, which is that, you know, he always, you know, he was always kind of nervous to get his to throw his, you know, to get wrapped up in someone else's life, you know, because they would be harder to extricate himself. And suddenly he found himself married to this woman he loves with two beautiful children, and, you know, all their finances mix in and they own a house together. And he said, you know, my marriage cannot fail. And that can have the opposite effect, because, you know, we talked to another couple where he had the same opinion, that he viewed his marriage as, you know, he compared himself to, like, Hernan Cortez, who, when he landed in the Western Hemisphere, you know, burned down all his ships and basically said, you guys are going to fight and conquer this land because you can't leave.
There's no going back.
There's no going back. Yeah. And this guy that we interviewed, you know, I mean, it was great, because on the one hand, she knew that he would be there no matter what, but the downside was he didn't realize that actually, there's no such thing as too big to fail in a marriage, you know? I mean, half of all marriages still end in divorce. They do fail. So in order to avoid that fate, you need to be paying attention to the marriage and not taking it for granted. And he didn't see the warning signs when actually things were getting really tough for her and she was very unhappy with their situation. And he just thought, you know, turn that frown upside down. You know, we're not going to fail. Well, you might, unless you take care of it.
Yeah. I think that it's, you know, not too long ago, I talked with a sociologist who'd done a lot of research on marriage and who had written a book on marriage. And of course, whenever you talk about marriage, the statistic that you cite is going to come up, that something
right.
like half of marriages end in failure. What's really interesting, I think, and tells us, all of this tells us something about how we approach marriage, is that, yes, it's true, we have in the United States a very high divorce rate, but we also have a very high marriage rate,
right.
and it is compared with other countries. Americans expect to be married, and we also have a very high rate of remarriage after people get divorced. So it means that they
the triumph
people,
of hope over
which, yeah,
experience.
People believe in it so much they keep trying.
Right.
But that also maybe says something about, well, what is it that we're looking for? What kind of personal satisfaction are we looking for? And that, again, goes back to the need to balance my satisfaction with your satisfaction.
Right. And that's what people say, you know, oh, God, isn't economics so unromantic and it's really about love? Well, you know, people didn't used to get married for love. People got married for economic reasons. You know, you each actually had a specialization. You know, the woman took care of the home and raised the kids, and the man went out and, you know, killed the buffalo or made the money at the advertising agency. And they were very prescribed roles, and they were necessary. And now they're not necessary. I mean, more women in this country, you know, now make up a greater percentage of the workforce, and that's never happened before. The only reason we get married is because we love each other, and that's awesome, but it's never been proven to make a lasting relationship. And yet, like you said, in this country, there was actually at Time did this great cover story a few months ago that said, you know, something like 30% of, you know, young people actually don't see the point of being married,
mm-hmm.
but only 5% didn't want to get married. So even though you don't see the point, you still want to do it. There's something compelling you to do it. And, you know, one of the things we talk about in the book is this idea of overconfidence, that it requires a great deal of confidence, and some would say overconfidence, to walk down the aisle knowing that there's a 50-50 chance that this isn't going to work. And, you know, spending, you know, $20,000 or whatever the U.S. average is of the cost of a wedding these days, you know, feeling like, of course, it's not going to fail. And, you know, we talk, great, that's romantic, and we're not saying people shouldn't do it, but we do talk about in this book the idea of booms and busts and economic cycles. And, you know, the economies are in boom times when people are extremely confident / overconfident about the fact that whatever they're invested in now can't fail. And that's what we just saw with real estate. People just were completely overconfident that real estate will not lose its value, period. Never will.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was completely incorrect. Everything can lose its value. And then, people came crashing down to reality. And, you know, not to say that your marriage is a subprime mortgage, but just, you know, be aware of, you know, there are some pitfalls to being too overconfident. And you can ignore some of the warning signs or some of the signs that you just need to work on these things and not assume that, you're not at the same risk that other people are at.
We'll talk with somebody else here up in DeKalb, in the northern part of the state, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know what? I'm having problems with mine right now as we speak, actually. And it has to do with jobs. All right. Now, I've been married 32, going on 33 years, and I'm about ready to pull the plug because it's getting insane. And it's not about who you love. It's come down to financial responsibility, and it's also come down to, what are you going to do with this person when they retire? Are you going to stay in the same room with them? Day in and day out, are you gonna be active? unfortunately, my wife always wants to do the same thing I do, and sometimes I want to be alone or with my buddies. And that's, I mean, to me, it's a big hang up because she doesn't have a lot of friends on her side. And so I know I'm paying the price. What would you say? You know, to be honest with you, a lot of people I know on Facebook are divorced. I don't think there's, out of probably 150 people I know, there's probably two that are still married.
Geesh.
Outside of me.
Yeah.
It's the truth. And you know, and it's the same story over and over again. You know, I don't know how my folks ended up making it 54 years, to be honest with you, because I'm kidding. I've only been married 32, going on 33, and I'm about ready done.
Well, I'm impressed that you made it to 32 years. See, I would have thought, oh, 32 years, clearly everything must be going well. But no, you see, people will always surprise you. You know, you think things are going well, and behind closed doors, you never know. I mean, you know, I don't know what to say, but I do find it interesting that, you know, we marriage is a whole series of trade-offs, you know, and that's what economists talk about. That's the way the world works. Everything is a trade-off. You want whatever you get one thing, you can't have another. So you get married, and the advantages you get, you know, the person that you love, you get to sleep in the same bed with them every night and do fun things with them and have children with them, and that's a great advantage. And the downside is, you know, no more sex with other people. You know, everything is a trade-off.
But I think the career thing is actually the big thing. I mean, I don't know about how you guys are portraying in the book. I should get this thing, but I honestly, so her career took off and mine floundered. I mean, I actually was the breadwinner in the family for a long, long time. And then the economy went south, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. Now she's doing it, and I'm not. And, you know, I'm playing heck trying to find a job that right. makes halfway decent money. And I get the complaint, well, you're not, you know, and it comes down to this. I find it's not, you can't sustain yourself with just love.
No.
You have to be able to give and take like the other person. And when I'm married, I said this is a 50-50 thing. And I got to tell you, right now it's like 80-20 because she's the one, and I can agree with her. But at the same time, you know, the economy is playing into the whole thing. And I've seen so many people break up just because of the economy issue on
right.
it. But anyway, I'll get off. Hmm. Thank you very much.
Well, and I don't know, you know, maybe you want to talk about that specifically, but I guess one of the things I wanted to raise, we talked earlier about how you can apply economic principles to things like who takes out the garbage and are
right.
you having sex? But, there are real economic
yes.
issues. And, of course, we know one of the things that people in relationships fight about is money.
Yeah,
they fight about, you know, who's making the money, who's bringing it in, where is it going, who decides how it's being spent.
Right. Right.
And that's a big source of conflict.
Well, I will say one, you know, and I don't know how much this will help the caller, but, I mean, two thoughts. And one is this idea that I talked about earlier of inequity aversion. And when things don't feel fair to us, we tend to lash out. And it could be that, you know, it's not feeling fair to her right now, that she's bringing in the money, and, you know, maybe it didn't feel fair to him before. But, you know, in marriages, like, again, there are cycles, and there are times when one person's going to be up and the other person's going to be down. And you know, you have to work on knowing that, you know, it could switch at any moment, and that's the beauty of marriage, but it's also the challenge of marriage. But I will also say there's this interesting idea that we talk in the book called, which is about, it's called thinking at the margin, marginal thinking. And it's how incremental change can have a big impact. And we did, you know, we spoke to couples who, like the guy who just called, were being hammered by the economy. And you know, one or the other suddenly wasn't making as much money or wasn't making any money, and that can really just hammer a marriage because suddenly the system that you had in place doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to reevaluate the system. But we tend to think of trade-offs as big things. Well, this isn't going to work until he gets a job, or this isn't going to work unless, you know, we have a bigger house. But lots of times there's ways that you can make really small changes that can have outsized impacts. You know, we talked to this couple where, you know, she really wanted to work, but she was raising the kids, and she was feeling this sense of lack of self-worth because she wasn't bringing in any money, and but she really liked to bake. She started to, like, bake cupcakes and sell it to the coffee shop next door. It's not that she was bringing in loads of money, but it started to give her the confidence to expand from there and to start her own catering business. And, again, that started with a very small change and with the sense of, you know what, I'm sending a signal to your spouse that you're doing something to change to change the situation, even though it might not seem like a huge thing at the time. So it's the power of small change, really.
I think it's interesting. People have a lot of different ways to deal with their family finances. And there are couples who, when they get married, right away, everything goes into a common, you know, they go from having separate checking accounts to having one checking account. And then I'm sure that there are people who maybe for periods, you know, long periods of time, people maintain separate accounts and they have common pots of money, but they have separate pots of money, you know, and there are some people who have to account for everything and where it's spent and sit down and have a big discussion about every dime. And then there are other people who are just a lot more casual, about it. Is there any one way that makes sense, or does it something that everybody just has to figure out what makes sense for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are pros and cons to each of them. You know, my husband and I are, you know, we are a friend of mine did a series for Slate magazine about, you know, how people share their money. And she, like, I think you said common potter.
Yeah, that's where I got it. Yeah, where I got it from.
And that's what, you know, that's what we are. We're common potters. The minute we moved in together, which was before we got married, we just combined all our finances. And, you know, what's great about it is that it reduces the, we don't have to think about as much. And again, that's a resource issue. It doesn't require as much debate about, you know, who's bringing in what, because we have made different amounts of money over the time we've been married, but it all goes into one common pot. You know, on the other hand, the downside of that is that there's an assumption that nobody's going to be spending that much more than the other person. So it can get a little dicey if suddenly one person, you know, wants to make a big purchase that the other person doesn't necessarily want to make. This is all completely hypothetical, of course.
Of course.
You know, and then you wouldn't have that problem if you have two separate accounts, you know. But on the other hand, you know, and I think actually people who maintain two completely separate accounts and don't combine their finances, you know, I couldn't do that. To me, it was an emotional issue to combine our finances. It felt like we were more of a unit when you combine money. You know, money is very emotional. And, you know, for people who keep it separate, I kind of applaud them because it feels like, well, you avoid all these issues. On the other hand, it's kind of like an easy out, right? I mean, it can be a disincentive to try and, you know, keep things together. Well, our money's not together, so why not keep it separate? And then, like you said, the people who do some of each, well, then there's a lot of keeping track. Like, are we sending this from our joint account, or is it coming out of our separate accounts? And that, to me, seems like a minefield, even though, you know, people do it. But, you know, it's all personal preference.
Yeah. Just for a second here, and unfortunately we got down to the point where we maybe have about 5 minutes, or 4 or 5 minutes, to coming back to thinking at the margin, I go back to the idea of people not having time for sex or not having time for each other or not having time for their family or, you know, whatever. And the fact that so many couples, both people are working and jobs are very demanding. They're having to give it everything they got.
Right.
You know, how it is you manage to carve out time for those things, whatever the thing is, for the thing that's really important. And this idea that little bits of time here and there
add up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's thinking at the margin. So, you know, you never have time for each other. Well, how do you make time? You know, do you think, okay, well, we're going to have to, you know, go away for a weekend sometime. Well, when are we going to go away for a weekend? And where are we going to go? And how are we going to find? Not to say that you shouldn't go away for the weekend. You should, but that takes a lot of planning and money, and that could take a while to plan. What's a lot easier is saying, okay, I'm going to leave work 15 minutes earlier every day. That's it. Just 15. You know, you're not going to get fired for leaving 15 minutes earlier. I mean, you might. Depends on your job, obviously. But I'm saying, you know, find the little bits of time here and there. You know, over the course of a week, 15 minutes times 5, you know, adds up to, what, an hour and 15 minutes that you suddenly have with your family that you didn't have before. You know, getting a babysitter for 2 hours, you know, on a Saturday afternoon. You know, having the babysitter take the kids out. Well, that's just 2 hours you get to, like, spend together. Maybe you have sex, maybe you don't, but, you know, it's a minimal cost for a maximum gain. You know, these little bits of time can feel so wonderful if you squirrel them away.
I'm sure in every interview you're asked now, having been through this process and spent time thinking about this and talking to a lot of other couples about how they deal with their issues and writing the book, did you learn some things that you could apply to your own marriage that you found helpful?
Well, loss aversion we talked about earlier has been a big one for us. And, you know, I have to put the onus on myself of, you know, I was the one who felt like we had to go to, you know, we couldn't go to bed angry and we had to resolve it. And, you know, even if my husband was cowering under the covers begging me to let him go to sleep, you know, I was like, no, you have to, you know, you have to hear my point of view, you know, saying it five different times, thinking if I just say it differently, he'll understand it. He'll see it my way. I definitely work on giving myself a time out now in ways that I never did before. You know, specialization and division of labor. We used to argue about, you know, who did what, and we used to feel constantly like it wasn't fair. And now, you know, I might sound like the luckiest girl in the world, but he does all the sweeping and mopping, and, you know, I pay all the bills. And sometimes, you know, like around tax time, for example, that feels like a lot of work, and I'd rather be doing the sweeping and mopping. But, you know, then again, most of the time, I really wouldn't. So, you know, we do have various other specializations, and, you know, that's something I can't even remember the last time we argued about that. So I definitely use that. And you know, just in general, I see the book as a set of tools. You know, it's 10 chapters, it's 10 different theories and a bunch of different theories in them, and they play out with different couples, and some tools work for some people and some they don't, but it's sort of it's been a totally new way of thinking for me and for Jenny as well.
Yeah. So of the people that you met, was there any couple that you met and you just thought, man, I wish we could be like these people, or I hope maybe in time to be like these people?
Gosh, yeah. I mean, we met a lot of really impressive couples who had, you know, been together for a while and figured things out. I think, you know, the couples that left the biggest impact on me were, you know, the couples that really gave each other space and had a lot of empathy. You know, empathy being a term that actually Adam Smith used. And, you know, you can't really share a world together unless you're able to put yourself in someone else's shoes. And that goes for societies and economies as well as, you know, two-person economies. So I really admire those kinds of people who can step out of themselves and imagine what it's like to be the other person and have a little empathy. That doesn't mean, you think like them. It just means you're able to have more compassionate ways of dealing with each other. So those
good.
Are sort of my models.
And that is a good thought on which to end, which we must. Our guest, Paula Schumann, is the page one editor at the Wall Street Journal. She is the co-author with Jenny Anderson. She's a reporter for the New York Times of the book Spousonomics, Using Economics to Master Love, Marriage, and Dirty Dishes. Random House is the publisher. Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.